Welcome back to Sheep Farm. This is episode 3 of Meet the Flockers. In this series, we're going to take a deep dive into the backgrounds of high-profile individuals, businesses, NGOs, or even historical events that have shaped all of our lives. Over the series, I will be joined by my brother Chris, and we'll investigate whether these people, or entities, can be trusted with the power they wield over all of us, or that big events were what we've been led to believe. In this episode, we're going to investigate our current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who, on the advice from the Bill Gates Disciples of Doom, has locked down the UK for 12 long months. His government has destroyed businesses, collapsed the economy, ruined children's education for generations to come, increased mental health problems, including suicides. This government has told people to stay away from the ones they love, and cancel thousands of life-saving operations, killing its own citizens in the process. And he's okayed non-resuscitation orders. Now that is hard to believe. Oh, and now we owe the global banksters upwards of 400 billion and counting. So who is Boris? Make no mistake, this guy is a true globalist. He's from a family of globalists. If Hancock and Whitty were made for the roles, Johnson was bred for it. So what is his ancestry? Has he got links to military, big businesses and global trust funds? Who the hell are these people? As always, we'll only use mainstream sources of information that is already in the public domain. And this video is available on YouTube at Sheep Farm Studios, because Sheep Farm was terminated. It will eventually be available on sheepfarm.co.uk when we launch the new website. So sit back and enjoy Sheep Farm 10, Meet the Flockers, Boris Bobo the Clown Johnson.
Good evening. The struggle against COVID is the single biggest crisis the world has faced in my lifetime. In less than a year, this disease has killed almost a million people and caused havoc to economies everywhere. Here in the UK, we mourn every person we have lost and we grieve with their families. And yet I'm more certain than ever that this is a struggle that humanity will win, and we in this country will win. And to achieve what we must, I want to talk to you directly tonight about the choices that we face, none of them easy, and why we must take action now.
It may be worth reminding ourselves why. The suggestion, as you can see, is that we send £350 million a week to the EU, which could be spent on the NHS. But it's important to recall that the UK does get a rebate, as well as money back in grants, which leaves the real figure at around £161 million a week.
Let's deal with your arguments. One of them is on the side of this bus. We send £350 million to Europe. We don't, and
we don't.
Admit that that figure is grotesquely misleading at best.
I won't. I'll tell you why not. Because that figure represents accurately the gross sum that is
sent. But a gross sum is meaningless. You've got the rebate, okay. You've got the public subsidy, so the true sum is 161 million.
Never in the history of our species, not since the Almighty felled the Tower of Babel.
So we in the UK, we're going to work with our friends, we're going to use our G7 presidency next year to create a new global approach to health security based on a 5-point plan to protect humanity against another pandemic.
In the last 20 years, there have been 8 outbreaks of a lethal virus, any one of which could have escalated into a pandemic. Bill Gates sounded the alert in 2015. 5 years ago, he gave that amazing prediction, Bill, almost every word of which has come true. How do we respond? As if to a persistent Microsoft error message, by clicking OK and carrying on.
We have secured a fantastic $8.8 billion for Gavi's vital work over the next 5 years. So take a bow, everybody. Thank you very, very much. I want to say a particular thanks, obviously, to you, to Bill, and to Melinda Gates for your generosity, your philanthropy yet again, your continued leadership in humanity's battle against disease.
You mean the, like the MMR and the BCG and all that jazz? Because there's all these anti-vaxxers now, isn't it?
Well, Marina can tell you a little bit about how we've achieved that.
Marina, what do you think of anti-vaxxers?
I've got no inhibitions about getting a vaccine, but I totally encourage everybody who is eligible for a vaccine. The people who are most vulnerable, of course, everybody should get a vaccine. You know, certainly, I would say to everybody, anti-vax is total nonsense. You should definitely get a vaccine.
I'm Ginny Blesky, and this is my daughter Mia, who's 12. On the 21st of September last year, 2016, she had the first HPV vaccination at school. The following morning she woke up and she couldn't walk on her legs. She couldn't wait there. Her legs were shaky and she had burning in either side of her spine all the way up her back.
Downing Street has just confirmed that the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has tested positive for a coronavirus. Boris Johnson has coronavirus.
Hi, folks. I want to bring you up to speed with something that's happening today, which is that I've developed mild symptoms of the coronavirus. That's to say, a temperature and a persistent cough.
All right, welcome to Sheep Farm 10, and this is third in the series of Meet the Flockers. And this one links in nicely with the last two we did about Ancock and the Sith Witty. This also completes a trilogy of clowns who have been pumping apocalyptic health warnings into people's brains every day since March last year. And like sponges, these gullible masses suck it all up. And today we're looking at the bumbling joke Prime Minister Bobo the Clown Johnson. I remember, and I'm sure Chris can remember, 7 years ago we had a chat, or several years ago, saying it looks like the grooming bozo up for the Prime Minister's job at some point. And recently we've had President Trump it, and now weirdo Biden, and in the UK we have bozo. And someone must be somewhere taking the piss. Boris, as you might see when we get through this evidence, is an actor on the world stage. He's also a eugenicist following in his father's footsteps. But his facade is dropping. Look at him compared to what he was like before the rebranding of flu. He looks like he's been possessed and he's aged drastically. Not that I feel sorry for him. Boris is going through some kind of mental breakdown. Or he's got a drink issue. Maybe both. Now, the amount of information there is about this tool is endless. And the links he has to royal bloodlines is also endless. We've picked what we feel is some of the most interesting. But this probably will go on for quite a while and we might need to break it into two parts. So let's see if Bobo the Clown is a complete flocker. What's your view, Chris? You haven't got your normal glass of red today. You're on water.
No, having a night off.
Night off the red.
Well, I remember we talked about, like you said, Johnson years ago, saying he were appearing on numerous TV shows. Have I Got News For You? I think we'll talk about that, but... Mayor doing that whole running thing with, against Ken Livingstone with the mayor thing, and then he didn't get in. Then he became so you immediately knew who he was, didn't you? You knew this guy was somebody. And I remember us talking about it. I think I was living in London at the time, talking about the fact he looked like they were lining him up for. I'm pretty sure we said that fact.
But we did.
He was on Have I Got News For You. He was on Top Gear. I think he said he was on EastEnders as well. Which, when you think about it, that's covering every dynamic of English population. You've got your Top Gear heads. You've got your leftist, I Think I'm Clever, I watch Have I Got News For You, which I used to watch. And then you've got EastEnders. And every one of those demographics is going to see this guy with his blonde hair and remember him as well.
And he were also on Parkinson.
And was he on Parkinson as well? Talking about what?
Yeah. Just nonsense. Just more nonsense. And Jonathan Ross.
Right, yeah. And you said he got nominated for a BAFTA for I Got News For You.
Yeah, he got nominated for a BAFTA.
Which, I mean, how do you even get a BAFTA for that? Who's presenting it?
Well, he's an actor, because on the IMDb, he's down as an actor. And, you know, that's what he is.
But that period of time was just used. It was, what, 5 or 6 years, 7 years, just to get him in everyone's face, wasn't it?
I'd say longer.
And then he did the Brexit thing as well.
Yeah, I'd say longer.
Yeah.
He was... This build-up of his persona as some sort of newly born Churchill were quite obvious, really.
Which I've heard people actually call him as well. And I think we talked about that as well.
Yeah, the funny thing is that I remember talking to wife's dad, and he's a pure Tory like our dad was.
Mm.
And I said to him, they're lining him up to be Prime Minister. He went, as if you'd vote for that clown. In December, he voted for him.
Oh, he's not a clown anymore. I do believe that is the... Because one of my good friends said the same thing when I said, you know, about what my opinion of Johnson. He said, well, you know, I said he's an idiot. And he said, no, he's just Johnson. He's an idiot. And he tries his best. And that, unfortunately, is the opinion that they want us to have. That he's just he's a bit bungling and a bit of a clown. But he's nice enough. He's got all his interests at heart and everything. But
yeah.
I think that is the fallacy. You'd
have a pint with him type of thing.
Yeah. He's a bit posh, but he's all right. He's a bit of a geezer. Yeah. You know?
Well, my wife's father-in-law said, well, he's better than Corbyn. Why would you wouldn't vote for him? He's useless. And I'm thinking, well, he's useless and Blue Team's useless as well. So yeah. I won't vote for either of them, regardless of who were in charge of them.
He was playing that director, wasn't they? The Corbett's a bit of a maverick. Why is he a maverick? Because he wears Benavidez puppies. Yeah. Tweed jacket.
Probably do something else with puppies. So what I want to do is go through that summary of those, which is something we haven't done before, the opening film montage and the videos. And we'll just pick a few things out. Just want to make people aware that when you listen to these people, that these speeches they're reading are prepared by people behind the scenes for different reasons than we can ever believe or think that they're doing them. And in video one, you'll see in his announcement, at number 10, which I think was taken from January when they were announcing that they were putting everybody in Starlag again, that he used words in that announcement. And one of the words he used was crisis. Now, to us, it's sort of an everyday life word, you know, and he used a crisis in his lifetime, not a health crisis, just crisis in his lifetime. Now, to us, the word crisis means a time of difficulty, hardship, danger. But the word crisis in Greek or Latin comes from the word, I'm going to try and pronounce this, krinein, spelled K-R-I-N-E-I-N. Sorry, E-I-N, yeah. Meaning to decide. And crisis with a K means decision. Translating to, in Greek and Latin again, a decisive point or a turning point or maybe the Great Reset. Now, Johnson, just to reiterate this, was a big fan of the Romans and studied classic Greek and Latin. So he knows these words. He knows what they mean. And so do the ones he's sending the messages to. And, you know, we could rip each thing in pieces and have a look at the whole announcement, but that would be a whole film in itself. But what do you think about that, Chris? Do you think that these speeches are written and they're written to give messages saying I'm still on track and this is showing you the point that I'm on track? Or
well, I watched that and it looked like it. I mean, why would you... It's just very odd, isn't it, bringing in the Tower of Babel, like you said, holding his hand up, saying five. Yeah, it's just very, come to that very one. Peculiar, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah. And, I mean, in the second video, we've just been talking about before we started recording, that video where he's talking about the bus... about the Brexit, £350 million a week saving for the NHS. Now, I'm not interested in the Brexit nonsense, nor really about saving the NHS £350 million. But it was an absolute lie, was that. And if you watch his behaviour, this is the person we're voting for. or people are voting for when him. And he's prime minister.
He knows he's lying as well, because they're both kind of laughing about it, aren't they? I mean, whether it's 35 million or 130 million, it shouldn't really matter, should it? It's a ridiculous amount of money that we'll never fathom. Yeah. But even their argument's almost like a fake argument.
It's like Punch and Judy.
Just laughing at each other, aren't they?
Yeah, it's pantomime stuff.
And it stinks of that he got caught out and he's had to make that video.
Well, one thing, this is the amount of respect they're showing for the public, for us, of our intelligence. This is where we've been brought down to childlike intelligence. And also, he's a guy who's not used to being asked these questions. He's used to getting his own way, as we'll see as we go through. Mm. And he doesn't want to be questioned and made to look a fool. So he's quite happy to bring us down to our childlike intelligence and argue a stupid point that he's obviously blatantly lying about. And I think it's easy to see that he's one of these liars, and he is a liar. Yeah. And he's done it over and over and over. Even with his first job, he's done it over and over again. And this example just proves that.
And even when I said
he's a liar,
when I said, like I said to my friend, he's an idiot. He's not an idiot, is he? He's not an idiot at all, I don't think.
No.
I think he's pretty smart, to be fair.
Yeah, I think he's pretty smart, but I think he's been brought in to do a job which he thought were Brexit, be king of England, if you like.
Yeah.
And
someone thrown last minute.
They've thrown this on his lap and said he's doing this now.
Looking into his history, he seems like a bit of a party boy, doesn't he? And
he's a bit of a party boy, and there's a lot of friends. There's one guy I was looking at. It's weird how these things take you down different roads when you're looking into stuff, innit? And there was a guy called David Ross. He started Carphone Warehouse up with Charles Dunstan, so he's a pretty wealthy guy. I think he's worth about 700 million or something like that. I suppose in dollars he's a billionaire. And he's one of his mates, and he's one who gives him donations.
Right.
Yeah, personal donations. I've looked on his, they've got to disclose donations, and I looked at his personal disclosure, and David Ross were on there. Right. And he's got an interesting story as well, because he was sort of done for fraud and things like this. And a lot of his one of his best mates, that guppy character, and we'll come on to that, I won't spoil that story. But there's quite a few of them that are involved in that. And the third video, the UN speech, like you said, he mentioned the Tower of Babel and the five-point star as references. And these show that he must be sending some kind of message, Masonic message, whatever, to his controllers, that he's actually staying on track. Because that's quite a big thing to say in a speech, isn't it? From nowhere, really.
It's a strange thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah, especially that. The five-point star of David, and he holds his hand up and actually goes with his five fingers spread wide. And also, the Tower of Babel is Genesis 11, chapters 1 to 9.
Right.
I mean...
Yeah. And it's what... I've got it here. Hang on a minute. The story of Tower of Babel explains the origins of multiplicity of languages. God was concerned that humans have blasphemed by building the tower to avoid a second flood. So God brought into existence multiple languages. Thus, humans were divided into linguistic groups and able to understand one another. I mean, divided is divided and conquered everybody. I mean, is that not what's happening right now?
You know, that's what's happening now. And also, it goes to say that we're not religious, but reading between the lines, they've split the languages. Now, he's talking a different language and we can't understand him. Mm-hmm. And we think we can understand him. Yeah?
Yeah.
That's what that sort of thing says to me.
Well, it's firing out some message, like I said, to somebody, isn't it?
Yeah. And he's also saying that Gates' prediction came exactly true. And no question of whether Gates has any part in the nonsense at all, or whether he's benefiting from it, or anybody behind the scenes is benefiting from it. If somebody said, right, I predict that there's going to be an epidemic 5 years ago and babbles on about it for the next 5 years, and he's got shares in all the major companies that are involved in it, or a lot of them, you'd have to say if you were in police force, definitely, he'd be a major suspect.
Definitely implicit somewhere down the line.
you'd have to say that, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
He's invested billions into making sure that we're epidemic, not prepared, scared.
You shouldn't be selling. You shouldn't be selling vaccines. You should be selling crystal balls if that's the case.
Yeah,
I'd buy one.
And also, now people are going to give him credit for sort of saying that there's going to be this pandemic and nobody listened to him, they're going to listen to him even more, a bit like that idiot Ferguson. If they listen to that idiot Ferguson and he gets nothing right, what's going to happen with Bill Gates? on video four, he's at the Bill Gates Gavi Summit, which were a live broadcast online. You need to go really watch all of that, and you'll see a lot of the world leaders there. It's another staged acting event with leaders nodding their heads like yelping poodles while selling their population down the sewer to the global cabals. 8.8 billion for vaccine out of nowhere. Out of nowhere, 8.8 billion. How many taps or water supplies could that get in Africa? Instantly, water's solved, or desalination plants, or everything, things like that.
Everything, world problems everywhere could be solved, couldn't it?
Yeah. Black magic money, and that's what it is to me. It's witchcraft. It's just made up from nowhere. Mm. And it really makes you wonder how humans survived and prospered, if that's what you want to call it, for so many years before we were jabbed up. Mm. You know, I needed all these drugs.
Shouldn't have been pandemics every year. Year in, year out. Well,
apparently there were, but everyone survived. Weird. Mm. We'll move on from them because we could go into the other videos where he's keeping on with the anti-vax nonsense. The idiots, like, with childlike names he goes on about, calling them nuts and things like that. And then there's a video of the poor girl that had the HPV vaccine that's in a wheelchair. Has he ever spoke to any of these people? Can he honestly say, which he ain't honest, can he honestly say that these things don't do you any harm?
Saying that the parents are nuts, basically.
Exactly. You're just nuts for caring about your kids. That's it. Did you see that Sky News presenter, one of the last ones, where he said, and Boris Johnson has tested positive, and he even started laughing.
So what do you think happened there? Do you think he didn't know that and he just read it off, and as he read it, he thought, "Fuck it off." like when Spankok laughed with William Shakespeare. I think he didn't know that was there. You know, that's when. Yeah. Do you remember when he started laughing and Piers Morgan says you're emotional? I don't think he knew there. I think that was a stitch up, and he just started pissing himself again, letting us know. Do you know what I mean? The whole world is staged.
Exactly. The last one where he had it was meant to have the flu, but he had no symptoms or no noticeable symptoms. He didn't even have a cough.
No, in fact, he did have symptoms because he came out of number 10 with his tie undone.
All right, yeah.
Slightly sweaty. So, what symptoms do you need than that?
why would he be outside? He needs to be staying in.
No, he just kept it self-isolating. He kept it off.
Right. So, I mean, I keep saying that these people, they're not like us either, and they've got no empathy, sympathy. They've just been bred that way. It's a bit like a general sending people out of trenches and, a thousand's been mown down. Send another 1,000. You know, it is a bit like that, isn't it? They can't have any empathy. Hmm. Otherwise, they wouldn't do that, would they? And this is a little bit similar. Johnson's an actor, and he acts for the cameras all the time. And then, surprise, surprise, flu's been rebranded. What gets me is eugenics in the research always plays part of any sort of proposition, and sadly, the murky world of abuse, either mental, physical, or sexual abuse, especially of children, always seems to crop up. And it surrounds, not necessarily that these individuals are involved, but it seems to surround the life that they're involved with. Yeah, well, these connections run deep. Unlike Hancock and Whitty, who have probably been made for positions of power or coerced into them, BJ has been bred for the money.
Yeah. Like I said, he reminds me of a spoiled print. Just even when he talks, you know, you can just imagine him with a little crown on running around.
I mean, he's another one that's attended all these Davos, more than most, actually, quite a few times, as mayor, as a cabinet minister. He's attended Davos on a lot of occasions. In my opinion, he's as shallow as spilt milk. What I'd like to point out is, though, that me and Chris, we're not political, so it just so happens that Conservatives are in power. And the Red Team's just blatantly as bad. They're doing nothing. In fact, they want to crank it up even more if they were in power. So that Starmer troubles me. His starry eyes, he looks like that old fascist leader, Oswald Mosley, if you ask me. But yeah, so we're not for the red or the blue teams. We think most politicians are compromised in one way or another. And likewise, the likes of Sage and all the people, a lot of the people that work for the NGOs, like the professors and things like that, are generally linked to Big Pharma. Or some sort of other corporate entity. So we'll make a start. That was quite a big intro that we talked about, but we're going to do this in two or three parts, maybe, because there's that much information that we've... it'll go on for about 4 hours otherwise, I think. So part one's about Johnson's background. I'll start off by going through from sort of like when he was born. So Johnson was born in 1964 on the 19th of June, making him 56 at the start of the flu rebrand for all you numerologists. Boris's full name is Alexander Boris de Pfeffel Johnson, and he is of French and German Bavarian royalty bloodlines. His granddad was from the Turkish Ottoman dynasty, and he was in the Turkish government for quite a while, and his distant cousins of both the Queen and obviously the Prince Charles, etc., and David Cameron. Now, what's the odds, Chris, right, on David Cameron and him being related, yeah, and both of them being related to Queen, illegitimately?
Well, there's no shock in this bizarro world, is there?
No, none whatsoever. And we'll talk about that later when we go into his ancestors, probably in part two. He was born, actually, in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, New York City, meaning he held UK and US passports until he denounced his US one in 2006. But he's still entitled to it, I would have thought. And as we know, this Muppet is the current moron to occupy number 10. His father is Stanley Johnson, who was 23 at the time of his birth and was studying economics at Columbia University. His mother was 22-year-old Charlotte Fawcett. Charlotte Fawcett was an Oxford-born artist from a family of liberal intellectuals. A lot of my friends were from a family of liberal intellectuals. Were yours, Chris?
Yeah, I always described it that way.
Charlotte and her Barney Rubble lookalike husband, Stanley, had four children, one girl and three boys. Johnson's parents had married in 1963 before moving to the US in September 1964. They returned to England. So Charlotte could study at the University of Oxford. And in February 1966, they went back and relocated to the US, to Washington, D.C., where Stanley got a job with the World Bank, as you do, and he worked directly for John D. Rockefeller III, as you do. And in 1967, Stanley got a new job with the Policy Panel on Population Control, and he also worked for Planned Parenthood, otherwise known as eugenics. We'll go into that more later, because that pops its head up in their family a lot and a lot and a lot. In April 1973, his dad got a job with the European Commission, and the Johnson family once again moved to a place called Ussel or Uccle in Belgium. Johnson attended the European School in Brussels and learnt to speak French. So he's not that stupid. He can pick languages up. He learns Greek and Latin and things like that. So he isn't stupid, I don't believe.
He's playing a part, like we said before.
Yeah. The current president of the EU is Ursula von der Leyen, who looks like Cruella de Vil. She went to that same school, and a lot of famous people went there, and a lot of influential people went there as well. During their time in Brussels, Johnson's mum, Charlotte, had a nervous breakdown and was hospitalised with clinical depression, otherwise known as she was committed to a hospital in London called the Maudsley Hospital for 4 weeks. Maudsley is a psychiatric hospital, quite a famous psychiatric hospital. I'll do a bit more further down the hospital. Charlotte was readmitted several times over the next 4 years. In 1975, Johnson and his siblings were sent back to England to attend Ashdown House, a preparatory school, boarding school in East Sussex. I'd say more like a predatory school, but that preparatory school, we'll go with that one. Here, Johnson developed his love for rugby and excelled at ancient Greek and Latin, as we said earlier, but was appalled at the teacher's use of corporal punishment. What about all the punishment you're dishing out now? You know, is that part of the process of payback as well? That's probably more on psychological level. To get a psychologist to have a conversation about that on here, wouldn't it? About these people. Or someone who could do some sort of body language and things like that. A few things stood out in that section for me. One of them was Stanley Johnson working directly for John Rockefeller III in working for the World Bank, in working for Planned Parenthood and Population Control with the European Council.
Is that what it's actually called, Don? Planned Parenthood and Population Control?
No, he worked for Planned Parenthood and he worked for... he did a piece of work on population control for the European Council.
Right.
And he did it in America as well. So we're quite heavily into population. And there's an interview with him, actually, that I don't think we can play because it's copyrighted and he keeps getting blocked by YouTube. But he's actually physically talking about the questioner asks him, what would be the ideal population of Great Britain? And he went 15 to 20 million people. And he said, I've been saying this for years. He says maximum 25 million. So that's just about 40 million less than we've got now.
Is that the one where he mentions the Club of Rome in that interview?
Yes, mentioned the Club of Rome in that. How fantastic that paper was from 1971.
So you've got a guy who wants to drop half the population and he's in Planned Parenthood population control.
Just a coincidence.
And then he suddenly is in charge of God knows what.
They'll go on a march to save the whales. Yeah. Which is fair enough. I don't want to see whales disappear. But whales and humans and schools, well, the right schools are especially important to these people. These schools breed the right type of people to run the world. The European School in Brussels is an important school. As I said earlier, Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, who Johnson and his fellow cabinet criminals were negotiating Brexit with, went to the European School in Brussels. Her father, Ernst Albrecht, was also a former high-ranking European civil servant from Germany. And his father, Karl Albrecht, was a German psychologist and psychotherapist and medical doctor who developed a new kind of meditation based on autogenic training and who was known for his psychological research on mystical consciousness during the 1930s. Now, I couldn't really find a lot of detail about him, but that period is within sort of sphere of Nazi Germany. And he's got an American mother. They're high up in American business, cotton manufacturing. So I would have thought cotton manufacturing, they might have been slave owners, I don't know, because there wasn't enough information there. But they had a lot of interesting people in their history as well. Her husband, Heiko Echter von der Leyen, is a professor of medicine and physician and a director of Hanover Clinical Trial Center, which I presume is carrying out the C-19 vaccine trials for Bayer. He's also a member of the German noble family, von der Leyen. So these are the type of people that go to these schools. Many people of influence went to the European School in Brussels, actors, pop stars, film directors, news journalists, models, fashion designers, authors, MPs, mayors, scientists, bankers, etc., etc. And just a steady conveyor belt of people falling off who run the world.
Or influence the world.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these people as well, who make an impact on everybody's day-to-day lives. Some of these people have gone on to join groups like the Council on Foreign Relations. And Ursula von der Leyen attended the Bilderberger meetings from 2016, 2018 and 2019 when she was German Foreign Minister or German Minister for Defence. So these people are pretty high up and being obviously poked and told what to do when they're in power. The Maudsley Hospital, where his mum went when she was committed, got a 1938 grant from no other than the Rockefeller Foundation. and the doctors and the hospital had links to with eugenic research and sterilisation. The Maudsley maintained its links with Germany, taking on both pro-Nazis and Jewish emigrates through fellowships provided by the Commonwealth Fund. And, after 1935, large-scale funds from the Rockefeller Foundation. Elliot Slater continued to visit Munich through the 1930s and contributed to academic festivals honouring Nazi eugenicist Ernst Rudin. During this time, Maudsley psychiatry developed a distinctive combination of practical experimentation and intellectual scepticism, whatever that means. Influential psychiatrist Aubrey Lewis became clinical director of the Maudsley in 1936. The Maudsley now run a program for teenagers called the Depersonalization Program. And this is what the NHS say depersonalization or derealization disorder is. Depersonalization is where you have a feeling of being outside yourself and observing your actions, feelings, or thoughts from a distance. Derealization is where you feel the world around you is unreal. And this disorder is caused by severe stress, such as a major relationship, financial or work-related issue, depression or anxiety, especially severe or prolonged depression, or anxiety with panic attacks. And also caused by use of recreational drugs, which can trigger episodes of depersonalization or derealization.
Well, I think I've got derealization. The world around me is unreal.
We were working up in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory every morning. Johnson mentions that he was appalled at the use of corporal punishment at Ashdown, but gives no more details on that. I'd like to find a bit more details of what he were on about there, but I think he's either witnessed something or he was part of the corporal punishment.
In that period of time, everyone dealt out corporal punishment. But like you said, it was a private school, so they won't have had to follow guidelines. They'll have had their own guidelines.
Well, they won't go home and say it because the parents will say, well, we spend 20 grand a year there, so tough.
Yeah.
You know, I should hope you are getting told what to do.
Yeah.
So we're going to play an edited down version of the abuse allegation at Ashdown School where Johnson went. The man who made this film is an investigative journalist called Alex Renton, and he was sexually abused at Ashdown around the same time Johnson went there. It wasn't there at the same time, but it was around the same time. Mr. Renton was abused by a paedophile teacher when he was just 8 years old. He says an estimated 1 million children are boarded at schools here in the UK. The reason we're playing this is because this could be a link to why psychologically, people in power turn out to be abusers themselves on a huge scale without any remorse at all. And they can smoothly lie about things and act out sadistic situations like they're being helpful. Look what we're going through now. It seems bonkers to me and you, Chris, and other people as well with a rational mind. It's no wonder they wish to turn us all into children, taking us down into the childlike mentality. Maybe they're stuck in their childhood. Remember, a large percentage of the abused become abusers themselves. These private schools turn out society's powerful leaders, politicians, bankers, media, civil servants, spies, etc. Is it any wonder that we're all living in a sadistic, psychotic world? These situations can also be used as leverage situations in later years. Remember the Tim Fortescue video we played you in the last witty video, where they saved up brownie points in a black book, only to show them later when they wanted a deal to be done. So we're going to play this video. It contains a few upsetting subjects, but it needs to be played to get a rounded view of what life was like for a young Boris Johnson at Ashdown School.
It was a brutal regime under my headmaster, Billy Williamson. You had to learn to live with it, our new life. But then there was the sexual abuse.
Mr. Keane was my maths and history teacher in that first year. My memory of my sexual encounter with him is only once, and it was in the classroom where he usually taught. And I remember very clearly the physical feeling of being pressed up against his sort of hairy tweed jacket while he had an arm around me and his other hand was going straight down the front of my corduroy shorts. And I remember quite distinctly being given the fruit gum afterwards, which I knew already was what you got if you submitted to this. But he was a very violent man, so I'm not sure what submission meant. I don't think you could have said no. Sorry. Okay, I just compose myself a little bit. It's funny how it's, you know, however many times you tell it, you really go.
These schools instilled in us a rule of silence, which has kept many boarding school survivors quiet most of their lives. But in 2013, a group of my former Ashdown House schoolmates spoke up. They went to the police about a different teacher from later in the 70s, Martin Haig, who'd taught science. I realised it was time to write an article about my own experience of abuse. It opened the floodgates. I was inundated with hundreds of emails from ex-boarders, some of them women, but the vast majority men, detailing abuse at schools up and down the country. And they were very hard to read.
You would be just laying across the teacher's lap and your pyjamas pulled down, and there would be some rubbing.
To mark our books with one hand, whilst feeling our buttocks and testicles with the other.
I told the headmaster, in so many words, because I didn't know the word, that my teacher had raped me. I never saw him again.
There were so many stories of abuse, I started compiling a database of all the allegations. And it soon became obvious the story wasn't just about rogue paedophile teachers. Even more shocking were the schools themselves and how they failed to deal with allegations of abuse and, in some cases, allowed it to continue. Of course, Ashdown House featured heavily, and several people had written to me about that science teacher, Martin Haig. In March last year, he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for indecent assault and gross indecency against four Ashdown pupils in the 70s. One of the men who gave evidence in court, an ex-Ashdown pupil who was a few years below me, has agreed to meet. He's asked to remain anonymous.
When Mr. Haig was first sexually abusive to you, how did that play out?
The first time he took me to his room for a slippering. He pulled my pants down, bent me over his bed, and then nothing happened. And he was just peering very close. I feel his breath on me. But it was more his dormitory activity that was really, really unsettling as well.
What was that?
His activity normally involved the entire dormitory, and he would get everybody to take their pants down and get an erection quickly, and then to test the power of the erection, he'd get us to hang things off the end of our penises. While we were doing this, he'd be like sort of walking around, peering closely at our bits and pieces.
So now we're going to Chris has wrote quite a lot of information about Ashdown School. And that video that we played there is quite a long video, and I suggest that you try and watch it all. I'll come to that in a bit, where you can find it on Sheep Farm Studios. So what did you dig up, Chris, there?
Well,
about John, about the school?
Well, first of all, the Ashdown in East Sussex is actually closed now, closed on the 1st of June 2020. It was built in 1794. Excuse me. Interestingly, with the same architect who designed the White House. There was accusations of abuse there from the 1970s. I took this piece from the Daily Mail in June. I think it was last year, it must have been. His sister, Rachel Johnson, she was the first girl ever to be sent there. And she described her father's determination to get Boris into that school because it was a stepping stone to get him into Eton. And he said his a dad didn't go and see the school, even though all his kids ended up going there. And he said he actually put a quote there. Why would I? A school with a perfectly good record of getting boys into Eton. So why would he bother going to see the school where Laura's kids are going to go, and where both of them actually say it was quite violent and they got quite abused there. So Stanley Johnson rang Ash down and he spoke to the joint head Clive Williams, telling him that he had just 4 terms to get his son through Ash down, which would give him a springboard into Eton. And then he would, and he subsequently got a scholarship to go to Eton. He also said, "We don't take girls." And he said, "You do now, because I've got 4 kids at home and I want them all to go to your school. If you don't let Boris in, I won't let any of them in." Now, it's just interesting as to how much clout Stanley's got to get a school to change its policy from only accepting boys to accepting boys and girls. How does that work for you?
It comes back down to that. Whoever's behind him, he's worked for John D. Rockefeller. The bloodline might have been identified as a royal bloodline, and this guy's getting pushed through on this conveyor belt, or the family is, as quick as possible, because they've all got high profile jobs. It's just that Boris's higher profile has got the character to take that.
But also
higher
that
profile on
that ties into you when you were saying about him going backwards and forwards from America to England, America to England. They obviously took him there, desperate to get him back into to get him. It's almost like someone decided at that point, we need to get him through that school, and he goes to Eton, and they're almost starting to set up the fucking pool balls, aren't they?
That's what it looks like. Get the ducks in a row, if you like.
Yeah. And his sister also said that, and this was all from the Daily Mail, by the way, that there were dire conditions, but she loved it. That then there was an independent inquiry into sexual abuse. The conclusion was there was sexual touching was rife for 25 years from 1969. Now, sexual touching sounds a lot worse than sexual abuse, doesn't it? I mean, sorry, a lot softer than sexual abuse, should I say.
Well, I think
it's still horrible.
Whatever that meant there has obviously been spun and softened and dusted down.
Yeah.
And
I don't think anyone got into trouble worse. For it. Did anyone get into that one guy?
I think one of them did. Yeah. I think one of them did. And only one of them in 25 years that it went on. I mean, he weren't there 25 years, so it had to be more of them. And you'll see, like at Stanley Johnson's school, one of the headmasters, he got the bullet because he was an abuser as well. So it goes on at these boarding schools. And how could a girl board there? They wouldn't even have facilities for a girl to board there. You know,
How many sisters did he have? Because they all went there.
One sister. He's got a stepsister as well, an half-sister.
I'm pretty sure it said another girl went there, but I might be wrong.
Right.
What was interesting was Princess Margaret removed her son mid-term after going and visiting him there. She removed him very suddenly for some reason. Maybe she saw some kind of... Or he complained about corporal punishment, I don't know.
He left with very few qualifications, as we'll see. I'd like to thank Mr. Renton. I think people like him are brave. I can't imagine what these poor people went through. He's a professionally investigated journalist and a very brave man. The full film is disturbing and upsetting. I'm not saying Boris was subject to any of this sexual abuse, but it seems like he was subject to some kind of corporal punishment abuse, because both him and his sister go on about it. He's publicly said that corporal punishment was terrible. So he either saw physical abuse or was subjected to it himself, or he heard about others getting some kind of abuse. Please watch the full version on Sheep Farm Studios on our YouTube channel. It's called Ashdown School Abuse. From a psychological point of view, as I said about Whitty, it's no wonder these people have no empathy and have psychotic tendencies. If they have been subjected to this kind of physical, mental or sexual abuse, it just doesn't surprise me that they can dish it out on others, whether it's in this country or abroad. In these elite competitive boarding schools, and they're there from incredibly young ages, from 6-year-old. I mean, can you imagine sending your kids at 6-year-old, separated from the family and friends, from the love and care and attention? This detachment from reality is reality to them. It becomes their reality. It becomes their normal. Family values to them equals pain, suffering and loneliness and abuse. That is their normal, their comfort zone, their childlike state of mind. And that is why we are all being taken down this road to think like children, because children are running the show and children are vulnerable like they were when they were separated and abandoned by their parents and put into a boarding school system and then abused to get better qualifications, to get better jobs to run the country. This is the price that they paid. And they were the people that were meant to be looking after them, you know, they were the ones, they were put in charge of these kids and they're the ones abusing them. The world is run by psychotics and they've managed to turn a small minority of psychotics into psychotics, should I say, to continue their work. If you think about that, psychotics, we want kids, well, nice blank computer chips, turn them into psychotics, and then they're going to continue to run the world. When we reviewed the film before launch, a friend of mine said that I might have misexplained what I was trying to talk about here. So I just want to clarify what I said, as I don't think I explained myself correctly. I should have said psychopath or classic sociopath, not psychotic. The differences to our understanding between psychotic and psychopaths are: a psychotic hears voices and can be or is delusional or hallucinogenic. These people are called schizophrenics and are usually controlled through antipsychotic medication. A psycho, however, refers to a psychopath or a classic sociopath, which is a personality disorder due to a lack of healthy attachments in childhood or abuse, which can result in lack of empathy, being egocentric with a parasitic trait, feeling entitled, lying and dishonesty, or narcissism. However, I feel, personally, that both are very much aligned and linked to one another. The loud and low voices we hear in our heads, we have been told, is our consciousness. However, these can be and have been provenly overridden via many ways. And abuse may also lead people to be and have psychotic tendencies through illegal use of amphetamines and prescription antidepressants and maybe even EMFs, etc., etc. I'm hopefully going to interview someone more experienced in this area than I ever will be in the coming months. Sorry for any misunderstanding. Let's get on with the film. Well, so one of the things I read about Stanley Johnson, he has actually said that he weren't a very good parent. He weren't there because he were gallivanting all around the world,
yeah.
Save the whales, save some shrub somewhere in Africa, going around Africa telling people that they need to look after this rhino and that rhino like it's his own. And I've got no problem with people being conservationists. But
well, if you think about it, boarding school at 6 years, 7 year old, 8 year old, whatever.
Exactly.
You're not off saying it's saving a flower.
Yeah, he's got this persona that he cares, and yet four of his kids are in boarding schools, abandoned.
Yeah.
In a school that commits abuse to them.
I think there's actually
on a daily basis.
I think there's actually a name for that. I can't remember what it is. Where you care more for animals than you do humans, and it's almost like a pretense that you care for. You're a caring person, and it's just pretending.
Cartoon land.
Yeah, she's what we're in anyway at the moment. Right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, let's move on. We're going to go from around about 77 to 1994 in this little section. In December 1978, his parents' relationship broke down. Not surprising, living with Stanley Barney Rubble Johnson, and they got divorced in 1980. Johnson gained a King's scholarship to study at Eton College. Surprise, surprise. He got into Eton, Chris.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And Eton, if you didn't know, is an elite independent boarding school, another boarding school, near Windsor in Berkshire. And he got there in 1977. Around this time, Johnson began using his middle name, Boris, as you would, rather than Alex. School reports complained about his idleness, complacency, and lateness. Not much has changed then. But he was said to be popular and well-known at Eton. So all noise and no substance. His friends were largely from the wealthy, upper middle and upper classes. Well, that's not really surprising because I would have thought all of the pupils would have been from the upper middle to upper classes.
I don't know anyone who went to Eton, do you?
Classes. Oh, no, I don't know anybody. I know some who went to Armley in Leeds.
That's more, that's boarding a, house.
That famous boarding house that Peter Sutcliffe were in at the time. He's one of his best friends, or he was best friends, with a chap called Darius Guppy, a man who was convicted of insurance fraud in 1993. And also Charles Spencer Churchill, now Earl Spencer, who, as we all know, was Princess Diana's brother and also part of the Vanderbilt family, along with the other Vanderbilt, Anderson CIA Mockingbird Cooper Vanderbilt. Guppy and Spencer both went to Oxford with Johnson and have remained friends with him ever since. In 1983, he was one of the generation of Oxford undergraduates who were later to become MPs and dominate British politics and media in the second decade of the 21st century. Among them were David Astor Cameron, William Jefferson Haig, now known as Baron Haig of Richmond, Michael Gove, Jeremy Hunt, yeah, I said Hunt, and Nick Bowles. All went on to become senior Conservative Party politicians. Johnson joined the old Etonian-dominated Bullingdon Club. Oh, ho, ho. Many years later, a group photograph of himself and Cameron in the Bullingdon Club formal dress caused a lot of negative press coverage, which I actually think probably released not to cause negative press coverage, but to re-embellish that Churchillian type persona that he's got. More on the Bullingdon Club in a bit. It was while at Oxford that Johnson entered a relationship with Allegra Mostyn Owen, a glamorous and popular fellow student from his own social background, whose family were of the military landed gentry class, where they owned a 1,500-acre estate called Woodhouse in Shropshire. Johnson and Allegra were engaged while at university, and in 1984, Johnson was elected Secretary of the Oxford Union and campaigned unsuccessfully for the career-enhancing important position of Oxford Union President, and he lost. In 1986, Johnson ran again, and this time was successful, so he became President of the Oxford Union, whatever that means, but his term was not particularly distinguished or memorable, and questions were raised regarding his competence and seriousness. There's a few alarm bells ringing here, Chris. Johnson was awarded an upper second-class degree, and he was deeply unhappy that he did not receive a first. Obviously, he's used to getting his way and used to getting first. And in 1987, Johnson and Mostyn Owen were married, and Johnson got a job at Leck Consulting, which lasted a week.
What happened in the week?
There are no details on that. I just put it down to him being useless. He got another job through his family connections at the Times that he went to work for after he'd left Leck Consulting. But Johnson was sacked by Charles Wilson, editor of the Times, for inventing a story that was fake, otherwise known as fake news. But more or less straight away, he got another job as a writer for the Daily Telegraph, having given the job to him by Professor Max Hastings, or should I say Sir Max Hastings, who was a professor at Oxford where he met him. Hastings is another knight, and he writes history books or history about British history, and he also seems to be another career guide that Johnson seems to have. These people that seem to give him a leg up when he's down. Many of his fellow journalists at the Daily Telegraph were critical of Johnson's articles, saying they contain lies. In fact, Tory politician Chris Patton later stated that Johnson was one of the greatest exponents of fake journalism. Interesting. But another nobility member came out of the woodwork to stick up for the lying Johnson. This time, it was the owner of the Telegraph, Conrad Black, otherwise known as Baron Black of Cross Harbour. He said of Johnson, "He was such an effective correspondent for us in Brussels that he greatly influenced opinion on this country's relations with Europe." Sounds like you were working for a hidden hand back then too, to me. Mm. And in 1990, Johnson's wife Allegra left him and they eventually divorced 3 years later in April 93, where Johnson married his childhood friend, Marina Wheeler, in May of 93. So a month after they were divorced, they were married again. And her father was Sir Charles Wheeler of the BBC. You see, the marriage always into some sort of royal...
What did he do for BBC?
Well, he was a correspondent. I've got a bit more further down. But he was quite an interesting character himself. And the person he worked for was quite interesting as well. He landed on D-Day with a special commando team. And he worked for Sir Ian Fleming.
Right.
He was his boss, yeah? So he was part of MI6. And then he goes to work for BBC. Two had two.
What'd you
do? Two had two. I can smell a mockingbird somewhere. And his wife worked for BBC as well. Pretty high up. Apparently, I think he invented Newsnight.
Her in 93, and then he appears on Have I Got News For You When? That was BBC.
Oh, no, that was sort of 2000s, early 2000s,
when they started
that TV appearance type stuff. No. Oh, no, it's not long after. No. Mm. So her mother and father worked at the BBC, high up at the BBC as well.
Right.
And he always, when there were a war on, he seemed to be always there, did Charles Wheeler.
Right.
He were like a war correspondent. If a war broke out, he happened to be there, right, type of thing.
Like Anderson Cooper is of school shooting.
Yeah. And they eventually, him and Marina, had four children together. So, side notes that were interesting, and I keep going on about this. Johnson seems to have these career guides that get him out of trouble and get him another job somewhere. It reminds me, Sir Max Hastings and Baron Conrad Black, when they're sheep dipping somebody, and I think I'll go into this a bit later on. Sir Max Hastings actually said when he was going to be Prime Minister, I was Johnson's boss and he's utterly unfit to be Prime Minister. So I think sort of fallen out with him at that point. He's not helping him through. He's realised the error of his mistakes.
Also, just to clarify, how did he get sacked from the Times, then get for lying in an article or being a lying journalist, basically, and then get another job in another newspaper? It should be impossible. That should be impossible.
It should be impossible, especially in journalism. I mean, I'm not saying I believe journalists, but there are some out there that no doubt still dig around for the truth.
Well, you did get the feeling there was a bit more credibility in journalism back in the 90s, a little bit, maybe. Maybe not, I don't know.
Maybe we were a bit more naive in the 90s, so yeah, we just thought it was true.
I was just thinking that as I said it.
but obviously they were making fake news up then. Mm. You know, they're still doing it now, but nobody gets outed. But how can he get outed for lying all the way through this? You know, he didn't get any qualifications, he's a failure, and yet he's Prime Minister. How does that work? Because he's a celebrity, obviously. I've wrote here, Johnson's lack of skill, integrity, experience and qualifications, but he still gets prime, high-profile jobs. Well, he's always on the up.
There's no evidence of any talent at all, is there?
None, apart from he talks in front of a camera. Hmm. That's his talent. That is his talent. It looks to me like his path's been, I'm not saying that there were a path there for him to be Prime Minister. There might well be. They might have planned this a long time ago. But there were certainly people greasing the tracks for him to do and get into certain positions of influence. So we're going to go into the Bullingdon Club and just do a bit of an explanation on the Bullingdon Club and what the Bullingdon Club was. There were a good film about the Bullingdon Club.
I never actually watched it. Did you watch it?
The Riot Club. I saw a bit of it, but didn't see it all. It wasn't right good, to be fair. But it's a good film about what the Bullingdon Club is. But then the interview's good with the people that made it. And there is an interview, which I couldn't get on here because they kept blocking it. So
it's based on a play, I believe,
right,
from 2010. The reason it hit my radar, because I just moved to Cambridge. So it was that kind of same...
scenery.
Yeah, exactly. So... Yeah. But it was based on a play called Posh from 2010.
Right.
Bullingdon Club, founded in 1780, limited to 30 men that can join it. Famous, I think that's what they use it for in the film, isn't it? Famous for destroying venues and then handing cash over to the venue operator. So like throwing cash at the peasants kind of thing.
Right.
It was originally a hunting and cricket club. Exclusive and expensive. New York Times said it's to its readers in 1913, so going back a bit, the Bullingdon represents the acme of exclusiveness at Oxford. It is the club of the sons of nobility and the sons of great wealth. Its membership represents the young bloods of the university. So, I don't, yeah, it's an odd one actually, isn't it? Now, primarily a dining club. So they don't really get involved in anything now other than going out eating. 2007 photo emerged, taken in 1987 with Boris and David Cameron, like you said earlier. Copyright owners have since declined to grant permission to use the picture at all. So could you get all that picture done?
I've got the pictures. Whether we can use it or not, I don't know, but I'm going to put it on.
What does it mean by that? Does that mean they can't put on TV or in newspapers anymore? I'm guessing.
Well, we might not be able to put it on this, but it's the pictures you can use for, like we're doing like a news story. So we should be able to use it. But anyway, we'll see.
There was a photo of George Osborne and Philip Rothschild together in 1992.
Nat Philip Rothschild.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
2013, yeah. The club members, they were caught with photos of on a private jet to South Africa, including hunting trip to South Africa, that is, by the way, including George Farmer, son of Farmer Conservative Party Treasurer. Sorry, that's what it is.
Right. And yeah, Joe Johnson.
Baron Michael Farmer.
So, do you say Joe Johnson were on it?
George Farm. I can't remember bloody writing there, sorry. Anyway, because they had this, they got caught on this jet hunting, photos taken, etc. They now say in 2016 that the club doesn't exist anymore. And it's gone, most people think it's gone underground.
Right. Because Joe Johnson's brother were in the Bullingdon Club, I think, as well.
Right.
At the same time with Nat Rothschild. So Osborne, Joe Johnson, and Joe Johnson now, as we'll find out, is a baron as well now. Mm. Not Joe Johnson, the snooker player. One thing I want to add is about that Conrad Black, Baron Conrad Black. In 2007, Black was convicted on 4 counts of fraud in the US District Court in Chicago. Baron Black was sentenced to jail and served more than 3 years. And he was pardoned fully because he'd written a book complimenting President Trumpet by President Trumpet, pardoned him in 2019.
Right.
So, Baron Black, you're right. It sounds like one of those...
I'm going to say Baron Conrad Black. It couldn't sound any more sinister if you tried.
No, he does. The next videos I'm going to play are of Johnson at the UN pushing the war on anti-vaxxers, along with a queen who didn't really look like the queen, having a jab for the nation. These videos prove that the people in power are actors and acting a part in a rather huge play, which is something we'll get into a little further on in the presentation.
It is a deep human instinct to be wary of any kind of technical progress. In 1829, they thought that the human frame would not withstand the speeds attained by Stevenson's rocket, and there are today people who are still actually anti-science. A whole movement called the anti-vaxxers, who refuse to acknowledge the evidence that vaccinations have eradicated smallpox, and who by their prejudices are actually endangering the very children they want to protect. And I totally reject this anti-scientific pessimism. I'm profoundly optimistic about the ability of new technology to serve as a liberator and to remake the world wondrously and benignly. Indeed, in countless respects, technology is already doing just that. Nanotechnology, I mentioned earlier, revolutionizing medicine by designing robots a fraction of the size of a red blood cell, capable of swimming through our bodies, dispensing medicine and attacking malignant cells like some Star Wars armada. Neural interface technology is producing a new generation of cochlear implants, allowing the gift of hearing to people who would otherwise not be able to hear the voices of their own children. A London technology company has worked out how to help the blind to navigate more freely with nothing more than an app on their smartphone.
Well, once you've had the vaccine, you have a feeling of, you're protected, which is, I think, very important. And as far as I can make out, it was quite harmless. It was very quick. And I've had lots of letters from people who've been very surprised by how easy it was to get the vaccine. And the jab was very, it didn't hurt at all.
The Queen never speaks about her own health, but sharing her experience with those leading the vaccination programme across the UK was for the greater good.
We know that this is probably the largest and most disruptive pandemic that we've faced both globally and within the UK for over 100 years.
It's a bit like a plague, isn't it? Because it's not only here that we've got the virus, but it's everywhere. So it's a strange battle that everybody's actually fighting. I think the other thing is that it is obviously difficult for people to, if they've never had a vaccine, they ought to think about other people rather than themselves.
The rest of the royal family have also been pushing that message. In the last week, Prince William visited a vaccination hub in Norfolk. Prince Charles and Camilla, who've had their jabs, visited another in Birmingham. And the Countess of Wessex has joined the 10,000 volunteers trained up to keep the centres running.
With Prince Philip still in hospital, the Queen has continued to do all of that work behind the scenes that is expected of her. And there is no doubt that the government and those within the health service will be delighted to receive her endorsement, as Her Majesty has pushed a very important public service message and the country continues to go through a difficult time.
It is remarkable how quickly the whole thing has been done. And so many people have had the vaccine already. So you will have to keep up the good work.
This has been a huge national endeavour and one that I certainly haven't seen of this scale before. We've seen all of those parts of the sector come together against rallying against a common cause, and it's been absolutely heartening to see.
Well, having lived in the war, it's very much like that, you know, when everybody had the same idea. And I think this has rather sort of inspired that, hasn't it?
And just as she did back then, she will continue doing her bit for her country. Rhiannon Mills, Sky News.
So there he was talking about nanotech in medicines with Johnson. And in September 2019, he's talking about designing robots a fraction of the size of red blood cells capable of swimming through our bodies, dispensing medicine and attacking malignant cells like some Star Wars armada. This is what is being injected into you if you have that jab. The Queen said, "It's a bit like the plague, isn't it? It's everywhere." That's when she was asked about seeing COVID-19. And people who are hesitant, she said, ought to think about other people rather than themselves. What do you mean, like Prince Andrew did when he met with Jeffrey Epstein and all those young girls? Or Sir Jimmy Savile and Prince Charles's mate?
Who had keys to Buckingham Palace.
Exactly, yeah. I think he ought to think of himself there, old Jimmy Savile.
Maybe he should turn Buckingham Palace into a blooming Weatherspoons if you want to stop being selfish.
Yeah.
Or a homeless shelter.
Yeah.
That's selfish.
Isn't it great how these people call others selfish, and yet they've never had to think about anything, no bills to pay or anything like that.
Never felt a pang of hunger.
No, never, never. Mm. And anyway, so to recap, with regards to Bullingdon Club, these people and others in these elite clubs are the ones running the country or the world. Not just in politics, but in every sort of job and nook and cranny that we see, whether it's at the World Health Organization, whether it's at an NGO like Oxfam or any. These are the people that are running all these places. So we're going to cover now from 1994 to 2008. Johnson's writing style was condemned by critics as bigotry. In his various newspaper columns, he used the words like pickaninnies and watermelon smiles when referring to Africans. And he championed European colonialism in Uganda and referred to gay men as tank-topped bum boys. I mean, just that alone, you aren't getting... Anybody else would not get into politics. He would never get back in.
No, that'd be brought up all the time.
Yeah, can you remember when he mentioned...
He should be constantly brought up.
Can you remember when he mentioned that? Well, there is an interview with him actually being asked about that. And the interview went very similar to that one on the bus. Right. Where he ended up turning into a child and having that stupid childlike conversation with him. And I'll actually put that on this film because it's pathetic. In 1995...
Prime Minister of the country, words like that should never have come out of his mouth, should they?
Well, he's
very difficult to apologise for.
He's writing for Guardian. He's not writing for some far-right movement, you know. He shouldn't even come out whether he were a politician or just in the Guardian, but anyway. In 1995, his old school friend, Darius Guppy, if you remember him, asked him to get a private address of a News of the World journalist called Stuart Collier. Collier was investigating Guppy's insurance fraud scam, and Guppy wanted to have Collier beaten up. The problem was, for some reason, the conversation, like everything in Johnson's life, was being recorded. When the phone conversation was published in 1995, Johnson stated that ultimately he had not obliged Guppy's request. But considering Johnson seems to be a pathological liar, how much credibility has he got there with his explanation? And yet again, his career angel, Sir Max Hastings, reprimanded Johnson, but did not dismiss him. So we're led to believe again that he's part of some sort of idea to get some guy beaten up. And whether he deserved it or not, I don't know, but he's now Prime Minister.
But even the fact that his mate Guppy rang him
to ask him,
to ask him, means he knew he was capable of giving him that information over, doesn't it? Whether he did or not. Well, so he knew what kind of character he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 1998, Johnson appeared on Have I Got News For You? And he was invited back on later episodes, including as a guest presenter. And for his 2003 appearance, Johnson received a nomination for the BAFTA Television Award for Best Entertainment Performance. It's like someone was steering him a little bit, wasn't it? You know, a BAFTA gets given to actors, in my opinion, not just some chancer.
And also, like you said, when did he get married to the BBC woman who's BBC?
About 10 years before this, wasn't it? Early night, but they were childhood friends, so it probably wouldn't have mattered that anyway.
1998, but he married her in 94, 4 years later, he's on BBC getting a BAFTA.
I know. Or a nomination, yeah. And,
nomination, yeah.
I mean, people strive for years and never get anywhere near that kind of thing, do they? Yeah, to get on TV like that, all right, to get on once, you probably don't need it, but you'd have to have an equity card. I would have thought so. To be nominated for a BAFTA, you'd have to have an equity card. If you've got an equity card, he played, King Richard or something like that at school. There was a big thing about it. I didn't go into detail on that because you could have gone into detail about loads of stuff about him playing King Richard, or I think it was, I might have got that wrong. And so he probably liked acting, yeah, is what I'm trying to say. And to get nominated for a BAFTA, I would have thought, and if anybody can correct us, tell us in sort of like the show notes, if you're not the show notes, but put a comment in, please. You'd have to have an equity card to get a BAFTA or be nominated for a BAFTA.
Like I said, he was also on Top Gear, wasn't he? And EastEnders.
Top Gear.
He was on TV a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and what's that guy?
They're all BBC, actually. They're all BBC fighting now.
Jonathan Ross, yeah. You're talking way back. Jonathan Ross show were just made, he was like made up. This guy got a tattoo on his leg or something like that of Boris Johnson. And that's why
that
we're on.
Mayor?
I think so, yeah. That's why he was... I mean, again, so they've got a story of somebody putting a tattoo on his leg to get him on Jonathan Ross show, to get him on television.
Yeah. What a load of crap.
I know.
Not even a story, is it?
No.
What was he then? Was he a mayor then?
I think so. I think he were a mayor. It were in 2000s anyway, when it was back in the... I think it was 2008 he became mayor. In August 2001, he became MP for Henley. And in August 2004, he backed unsuccessful impeachment procedures against Prime Minister Tony Blair, otherwise known as Tony Blair, for high crimes and misdemeanors regarding the war in Iraq. And in December 2006, he described the Iraq invasion as a colossal mistake and misadventure. How times change. I wonder if he'll be taken to court in years to come. In 2004, it emerged that BJ was having an affair with fellow Spectator columnist Patronella Wyatt. I know quite a lot of girls that went to our school called Patronella. Resulting in her having two terminated pregnancies. I think she...
How do you know, why is that even in the public domain?
Well, I think they wanted him, obviously, to have this personality or persona as some sort of Lothario. I mean, he doesn't look like a Lothario to me, does he? But
not really.
After it was proven that Johnson had lied, he was eventually sacked. So he was asked about whether he'd had an affair, and he said no. And Tory leader Michael Howard, who was then Tory leader, sacked him from his shadow arts minister job. And in
what does the shadow arts minister do?
Well, I don't know, but... it'd been better called Shadow Martial Arts Minister. In 2005, BBC numbnut Andrew Neil, over at The Spectator, he took over there, did Andrew Neil. You might know him, Andrew Neil, with that weird hair that he got stuck on that dead cat.
Got a crap toupee, isn't
it? Yeah. He took over at The Spectator and sacked Johnson as editor at that time. So there seems to be quite a lot of sackings of Johnson.
I'm going to say, how many times has he got sacked? Yeah. I've not got sacked that many times.
His salary was around the 250 grand mark. In 2007, he earned 530,000, making him the third highest paid MP, which seems to be quite a big thing for him to be highly paid. So some side notes I wrote. How does he keep getting these jobs? He's a racist, bigot, coming out with homophobic. If you said that at work, right, you'd be out. He'll be out, done. And he gets also, job after job after job.
Why is he the highest earned? Why is he earning the most money? What reason?
Well, he's writing columns for people and he's probably sitting on boards or directors or stuff like that. He's just getting paid from different places. I'll come on to some of his pay in a bit. How's this work, though? He's recorded working for a major newspaper with his friend. You know, he wants to get a fellow journalist beaten up, yet he's not fired. That bit, how does that work? This is a sort of like profession. It's a fellow journalist, and he's been called, like you said earlier. That guy must have thought he were going to give him his details. And whether he did or not, we'll never know. But also, who were recording the call? Why was it being recorded? Yeah. That doesn't make sense either. Because it's not the police that say it were recorded, and it were a newspaper that got hold of the recording.
Are they just listening to everything he does or recording everything he does?
It's strange. And Sir Max Hastings, as mentioned before, seems to be one of these establishment career guides. Ask yourself, if you were involved in something like that, do you think you'd be able to become PM or even a manager at the place, your place of work? Johnson seems to be above the law, as he seems to be now. You know, he seems to be just doing what he wants and making rules up as he goes along. I think we've seen this before in people like, say, Charles Manson, James Earl Ray, Jimmy Savile, Peter Sutcliffe, Fred and Rose West, etc. All seem to have either been groomed and allowed to continue their crimes for some kind of operation or future plan. And when you look at, say, Charles Manson, you read a lot of books on Charles Manson, you see that he were arrested and then there were a big gap until the stuff that he did at Sharon Tate stuff. But he was still doing crimes and he was never arrested. I think they
and
call
also
it...
the Beach Boys were quoted saying none of their music could exist if it weren't for Charles Manson.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
well, I think Mark Devlin and that written stuff like that, haven't they? About him talking about that. But anyway, that gap says to me, still committing crimes but never arrested. And I think in this country they call it under observation, don't they? If you're under observation, there's a mark on you and you don't get stopped or you get let go straight away and things like that. But
maybe why his phone has been tapped.
Exactly, that's what I mean. Maybe he's under observation from MI6, which his wife.
If they're lining him up for Prime Minister, they've been watching him.
Well, if his wife's father was in a secret commando team run by an MI6 agent. I would hazard a guess he's got some connections into MI6. And also, he must have been some sort of security risk as well, having affairs and all that type of stuff. So here's another video coming up with Johnson's...
It might have actually been like Meet the Flockers.
Yeah, it might have been.
And De Niro's watching his son-in-law.
Could have been.
Maybe that's what happened.
Here's a video coming up where Johnson's Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, is at the UN meeting. Well, it's like an online virtual meeting. And Raab explains human rights to us. This man's another government condescending twat, in my opinion. please watch, again, the full film on Sheet 5 Studios called Dominic Raab Pushes Condescending Government Nonsense. I've edited and added video where I feel fit to show the contradictions.
Madam President, Excellencies, the UK places the promotion and protection of human rights at the very top of our list of international priorities. So we're very pleased to return to the Human Rights Council, and we will continue to uphold and defend the international rule of law and the rights and freedoms of people right around the world. We place a particular focus on championing freedom of religion and belief, defending media freedom, and also championing the values of liberal democracy. We will use all of the diplomatic and development levers available to us to pursue these ends, support states to meet their human rights obligations, and uphold the values on which the United Nations was founded. The Human Rights Council has a key role to play. And at this moment, when we see the democratic dominoes falling across the world, when we see appalling human rights violations, and when we see some governments using COVID as a pretext to row back on personal freedoms, this council's role is even more important than ever. But like any institution, we know the council's not perfect. Some members don't meet the human rights standards we vow to uphold, and the council's agenda doesn't consistently reflect where the most pressing human rights issues are. We need to address that, as well as other institutional concerns. For our part, the UK will continue to engage with all sides to find ways to do so. The UK wants the council to succeed, and we will work with our international partners. We will continue to speak up in this council for what is right, and we will continue to back up our words with actions. Thank you.
All right, Raab is another puppet talking about freedom and free will and free press, blah, blah, blah. Nicely spoken, boy next door, making decisions that will possibly affect billions of people for many years to come. And that is what this does. These people make decisions, and 20 years later, it affects hundreds of millions, billions of people. So we're going to go from mayor to prime minister now. It's not quite a lot as long as you think, this one, but I didn't want to get into a load of detail about him being mayor. We could have got lost in some sort of quicksand there. Johnson was elected mayor in 2008, and Johnson confided to another baron, Baron Paddock, that he was unsure how he would retain his then lifestyle, relying on a paltry salary of just £140,000 a year. So he agreed to continue his Telegraph column, adding a further £250,000 a year to his earnings. In other words, someone let him do that job to keep him sweet for what was coming down the pipe. His team believed that this would cause controversy and made him promise to donate a fifth of his Telegraph fee to charitable causes, providing bursaries for students. Johnson resented this and ultimately did not give a full fifth. Controversy erupted when he was questioned about his Telegraph fee on BBC Hard Talk. Here, he referred to the £250,000 as chicken feed. And I'll play that video. And that's the one I was just on about a bit ago. Something that was condemned, given that this was roughly 10 times the average yearly wage of people at that particular point. In 2014, Johnson pushed his biography of Winston Churchill, The Churchill Factor, with media emphasising how Johnson repeatedly compared himself to Churchill. Like I said, he's an actor, playing a part. Johnson was London Mayor from 2008 to 2016, and he became Foreign Secretary under his mate David Cameron while Cameron was Prime Minister. He became leader of the Conservatives when Theresa May resigned in July 2019, and Johnson was elected in the elections Prime Minister in December of 2019. So, out of all that background there, up to him being Prime Minister, it looks to me like we're on some sort of career path to be set up as the new Churchill along the way.
Interesting as well, Fatty, just going up in these 10 years up to this, how many films and documentaries were out about Churchill.
Yeah.
That famous one with Gary Oldman in, but there's a few others as well.
Yeah.
They're all leading up to this point in time. And then now we've got his new Churchill. We're being groomed with Churchill films.
Yeah, they were Dunkirk as well, weren't they?
Dunkirk as well, yeah. There's a lot of that stuff around.
Yeah.
That, you know, war mentality.
In fact,
that's what they said at the beginning of this, didn't they?
Damian Lewis were in a Dunkirk BBC production, I think it was BBC, quite a while ago. It might have been 5 or 6 years ago. Not longer. It might have been 10 years ago. And he was in a Dunkirk one before the film. And he went to Ashdown right. House as well. Yeah. With Damian Lewis. Yeah. So I don't think he went. I don't think he went at the same time as Boris, but he was at Ashdown House at the time all the abuse was going on. So Damian Lewis,
crossover, yeah.
You know who Damian Lewis is, don't you? That actor,
yeah, I can see
ginger hair guy.
Yeah. Wasn't he in Boys that one you used to watch, that Second World War one?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, Band of Brothers.
That's yeah. Where he came from. Wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. That where his first sort of break came from.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks, world stage actor.
Yeah, exactly. Another bit of war propaganda. Yeah. Fired straight out.
Yeah. How do they keep this war propaganda going? You know, So not only is he like the new Churchill, but he's sacked for lying in government, but then still gets the Prime Minister's job. And Churchill, I'm not buying the fake Churchill story. I'm just not. Another alcoholic, another flamboyant character. And if you read a lot of his history, you'll see the holes in it like a teabag. Mm. The chicken feed statement shows that he's not in touch with anybody, working people or middle classes or anybody. And if you think he's out to look after us, then he isn't. He's out to fill the pockets of his friends who are bankers. And there's going to be a video on here about him saying we should be clapping the NHS, but we should also clap the financiers. In this next video, is Boris pushing the Rothschilds' banking interests, and a speech he gives where he says we should clap for global bankers, as well as the NHS staff.
My friends, I am not a communist. I believe it is also the job of government to create the conditions for free market enterprise. And yes, we clap for our NHS. But under this government, we also applaud those who make our NHS possible. Our innovators, our wealth creators, our capitalists, our financiers. Because in the end, it's their willingness to take risks with their own money that will be crucial for our future success.
The group downstairs was in complete agreement that the UK initiative that requires companies with over 250 employees to disclose to the public what their ratio of women to total workforce is a very important step toward getting us to finally have gender equality in our nations.
And the other thing that we're doing is making sure that people can see whether women are paid less than men, and if so, by how much. And the reason we want to expose that from April next year is not just because it's the right thing to do, though it is, but also if all the evidence is that where women are paid the same as men, where you have equality in the workforce, your company will be more productive, more dynamic, and more competitive. So people can see which of the good companies are and which they want to invest in.
Now, you are the Mayor of London. I checked this morning. I believe your salary is just short of £140,000. You have a massive job. You've just told me how dizzyingly exciting and challenging it is. And yet, you have a contract...
Yeah, I do.
with a national newspaper worth £250,000 a year.
Chicken feed.
Those videos, or that first one, shows that true power lies with the global banksters. Just look how much money they've made during the rebrand of flu. 400 billion here, trillions of dollars globally. It proves that money has no real financial worth to them. But to us, it's used as an enslaving tool. And when I see people like Johnson and other leaders cooing up to the Rothschilds, it really sets off alarm bells. His comment about £340,000 a year in 2009 being chicken feed not just shows he's out of touch, but detached from all reality. Well, that's it for Boris Johnson Part 1. Join us next time for Part 2, when the discussion gets even more interesting, when we talk about Johnson's wives, affairs, and the rest of his family clan. Remember, we're all sheep and we're all being farmed, but some of us are trying really hard to escape. Bye! Of the earth.